Welcome to the podcast series, Blindingly Obvious. My name is Minnie Baragwanath, and this series is based on my book by the same name. Blindingly Obvious is my story. It is a candid and deeply personal story about my life and work as a blind woman, social entrepreneur, and innovator. I wrote it in order to share my experience of blindness with others, and in the hope that it might raise awareness and invite others to actively create a more accessible future, one that is full of possibility. A wonderful voiceover artist and now friend of mine, Romy Hooper, has narrated my full book, all 24 chapters. I do so hope you enjoy listening. It is an absolute pleasure to be able to share it with you.
17. Valuing Accessibility. It was early January 2008, and I was at lunch with some old family friends, the Shirleys. Mary and Ian were very good friends of my mother's from Palmerston North days. Ian had moved up from Massey University and was now a professor at AUT. There was a group of academics, including Ian, Marilyn Waring, the former MP and author, as well as Dr. David Wilson, later to become a board member at Be Accessible, who had recently established a new program at AUT in economic development. A former community development practitioner himself, Ian was now very interested in how councils and their economic development agencies could impact powerful social change at the local and regional levels. Ian and Mary lived in Ponsonby in a beautiful old house, filled with Mary's incredible artwork. They regularly hosted the most glorious lunches in their spectacular garden, designed by my clever mother, Rosemary, just by the way, with a range of interesting people from all walks of life and from all around the world. It took me back to our days in Palmerston North when Mum would host the most interesting people for lunches and dinners. After I had shared my experience of Leadership New Zealand and Tamarack with him, Ian suggested I might like to apply for the new postgraduate diploma that he had established a couple of years earlier. The course was designed to be undertaken by people in full-time work, so it was set across 2 years as a part-time program. I jumped at the opportunity. However, before the course started in March that year, I had one more overseas adventure of my own to undertake. I had been selected to lead a group to go to Japan. Yes, that's right, Japan, that unforgettable old friend of mine. Every year, the Japanese government would invite groups from various countries to come and visit them in an effort to share knowledge and information in the three areas of youth, older people, and disabled people. It was part of an exchange program called the Core Leaders of Civil Society. Catchy. Going back to Japan at this point in my life, nearly 20 years after my first trip, was fascinating. I knew that while on the one hand, things had ended rather dramatically for me all those years before, I realized I also felt a deep love for Japan. I immediately felt a deep sense of familiarity. I felt as if I had come home. I relished walking past the old wooden noodle bars, the smell of fresh sushi and soya sauce, the amazing outfits being worn by young Japanese fashionistas, and the beauty of the architecture and extraordinary elements of design, both cutting-edge contemporary and ancient and traditional. This time, instead of being hosted by a family, we were put up in a lavish hotel in the heart of Tokyo. We were the guest of the government and were shown extraordinary respect and treated like royalty. While the last time I had been in Japan, I had been there to live and to work as a teacher, this time I was visiting with a view to studying Japan's approach to access. And this was very eye-opening indeed. I soon realized that in many ways, the built environment, particularly the streets and buildings, certainly in the big cities, had pretty good physical or wheelchair access in place. However, my concern, and yes, shock, lay in other areas. One of my dear friends and colleagues in the New Zealand contingent, who has autism, was not shown the same respect as the rest of us. It turned out that rather than being hosted in a hotel, he was put into a locked psychiatric institution. He was expected to stay there at night during his stay. We were beyond shocked. Not in our wildest dreams could we have imagined this happening. It also became apparent that while the New Zealand contingent was made up of disabled people and led by a blind woman, me, the Japanese groups we met were almost always only made up of able-bodied people, speaking on behalf of the disabled Japanese population. The disabled Japanese themselves were never actually present, never visible, certainly never in leadership roles. It made me realise that perhaps New Zealand was doing better than I thought in some areas of equality after all. One of the most interesting moments that truly highlighted cultural differences came for me at one of our many formal dinners. I had just given a speech acknowledging our generous hosts, the Japanese government, and praising the huge value of exchange programs such as the Core Leaders of Civil Society. Then my jaw dropped in total disbelief. It was now about 10 minutes after I had spoken, and one of the high-ranking government officials was presenting. My friend who was there representing a youth perspective on the program turned and looked at me. "Isn't that your speech?" he said. "Is the speaker using the exact words from the speech you just gave?" Well, yes, he was. It turns out that it is not uncommon for such plagiarism to occur in these types of situations. Whereas I could never in my wildest dreams imagine so blatantly stealing someone else's speech, word for word, 10 minutes after they have just spoken, in Japan, this is not seen as a problem at all. In fact, some say it is a huge compliment. Well, that is how I chose to take it, I think. This trip to Japan, just before I started my new course of study at AUT, was perfectly timed. I came back even more fired up and ready to learn. I could now see the importance of considering the cultural context in addressing accessibility. During my time in Japan, employment and economic development did not come up once. The country, or at least the things we were exposed to, was very much framed up in a charity approach to disability and disabled people. Economic empowerment still felt a million miles away. Back in New Zealand, I now took to the Economic Development Program at AUT like a fish to water. I loved it. I loved the mix of theory and practice. I loved learning about different approaches to growing strong economies at local and regional levels throughout New Zealand. I loved learning about the newly emerging contemporary Māori economy. And I learned how we often only value what we can tangibly measure in society. So what we measure becomes hugely important. Marilyn Waring's book, Counting for Nothing, had a huge impact on me. It illustrated how GDP does not account for all the unpaid labour of women in the household. And yet this labour, if valued in financial terms, would be worth billions. I became fascinated with the concept of value, and in particular, how we do or do not value certain groups in our society and economy. I was, of course, particularly interested in how Aotearoa has or has not valued the contribution of access citizens over the last couple of centuries. One of my most significant learnings was that according to Jean-Baptiste Say, a 19th century French economist, the word entrepreneur actually means value creator, someone who creates value. How fabulous. What would happen, I wondered, if we actively nurtured and recognised access entrepreneurs? And what would an access entrepreneur even look like or do? What would creating value in the area of access look like? This was something I dedicated myself to exploring when we set up the Global Centre of Possibility at AUT about 10 years later. One of my assignments focused entirely on the history of employment for disabled New Zealanders. I tried to identify all the critical social, political, and cultural factors that have shaped our modern-day attitudes towards access citizens. These included the influence of Darwinism and his notions about the survival of the fittest, the importance of physical fitness amongst early pioneers, the social impact of returning war veterans on our concept of the disabled hero, the impact of legislative change, including the Building Code, to ensure greater physical access to buildings, and the recent rise of computer and other technology to potentially open up new employment possibilities. I could now see why, in so many ways, we have such deeply ingrained prejudice around employing disabled people in today's world. I could understand where this attitude had stemmed from, and ultimately, why Access citizens were so underemployed in our economy. How to shift this was an entirely different issue, and one that I would start to address with my amazing team and board a couple of years later, with the start of Be Accessible and our employment program, Be Employed. I now knew we needed to update society's idea of who the Access employee was and just exactly what they could bring to the right role. In a sense, we needed to introduce the concept of a 21st century Access employee and get rid of terribly outdated concepts that had been holding everyone back in the dark ages. One of the reasons it was so confronting looking at the systemic issues that held back the employment of Access citizens in my study was that I was continuing to face difficult challenges in my own work life during this period. One of my managers decided that it would be a good idea for me to present to the wider team and department on my sight and what it was like to be blind. I agreed to do this in the hope that it would build greater understanding and awareness throughout the team. But it occurred to me after I had done the presentation that there was a better way of doing this, and that singling me out was not cool. Why do we never ask bald men what it's like to be in work? Or brunettes who wear pantsuits? However, the real issue came 2 days later at a council team building exercise. After having poured my heart out standing in front of 30 colleagues, sharing my experience of being blind in my life and in the workplace, an outrageous thing happened. My manager decided that we needed some team building exercises to get to know each other better and to build connections. What I know to be sadly very true is that 90% of team building exercises are 100% inaccessible. They are often the worst embodiment of how to ensure the disabled staff member does not feel part of a team because they cannot do the exercise. This particular day, the chosen exercise was to throw a tiny ball at each other across the large room in the central library. We were to call out the name of the person we were throwing it at as we did so. Well, hello? Really? How could anyone who had heard my talk 2 days earlier not know that this was at worst unthinking and at best cruel? I refused to take part. By the way, this was the first time I had ever said no in a situation like this. Then, as I was about to burst into tears of disbelief, my manager exploded at me. In front of everyone, she literally screamed at me that I was a terrible team player, that I did not participate well, and that I had to take part. I walked out and vowed that day that somehow I would find a different job. I never took a case against my manager. I never told anyone more senior than her, as I did not feel I would be listened to or taken seriously. But I vowed I would never do a blind awareness session about myself in that way again. Surely the unspoken social contract is that if you ask someone to do this, you have a duty to listen and to truly pay attention. This had not happened. I might as well have not given my presentation. My employment challenges did not stop there. In the nearly 10 years I had been at the council, not once had anyone approached me about a role change or a promotion. And to make matters worse, I was still having so many issues with my computer that any roles that were available on the intranet were inaccessible to me. I could not use the council intranet at all. About 6 years into my work with council, a review was conducted of our department. It turned out that for years, I had been paid less than anyone else in the department. During my economic development study, we often travelled to interesting locations around New Zealand. One of our most memorable program sessions was held at a retreat centre just north of Auckland. We were given an assignment at the start of the weekend and were expected to give a report and presentation by the end of the following day. As fate would have it, my computer simply would not work. How surprising. I definitely felt I was on the back foot. However, I tried not to let this derail me, even though the assignment was worth 20% of our final mark. So I set about creating a short performance in which I acted out my understanding of the social economy. Instead of the stock standard PowerPoint presentation, I gave a one-woman theatre performance. Luckily, my lecturers were evolved enough to value this alternative, and, I thought, rather resourceful approach. Thankfully, I ended up doing quite well with that mark. By now, I was becoming aware that if I were to make it in this world, I would often have to find alternative ways of approaching challenges. I would have to think outside the square, because the square was usually inaccessible. In both LNZ and through this program with AUT, we were actively encouraged to pay attention to the world around us and to learn to see and recognize significant trends or patterns that were emerging. The late 2000s were a very interesting time in both Auckland and New Zealand. Back in my work at the Council, the Disability Issues Advisory Group and I were keen to host a workshop to really look at the changes that were on the way. We wanted to examine how we might need to respond to these changes, both in terms of risk and opportunity to our work and the advancement of access. I reached out to Mary Jane Rivers, the amazing woman I had spent time with in Canada, and one of our most experienced community development practitioners. She was now establishing the groundbreaking organisation Inspiring Communities throughout Aotearoa. Mary Jane agreed to host a strategy workshop with the Disability Issues Advisory Group and a small group of other key stakeholders to identify how we might progress access over the next few years. Two critical and perhaps surprising areas of focus emerged from this: the Rugby World Cup and the pending Auckland Super City. Thanks to a Royal Commission report, planning was now underway to turn the eight councils that made up Auckland into one super city structure. As the disability community, we were concerned at what this might mean if access was not a priority in this new structure. On the positive side, we could also see that this new super city might also provide an incredible opportunity to advance access consistently across the vast city and region of Auckland. The second area of opportunity that we identified was the upcoming Rugby World Cup to be hosted by New Zealand in 2011. It had become a well-known fact that cities often experienced a dramatic improvement in access after hosting the Olympics and the sister event, the Paralympics. All the investment that went into the infrastructure, as well as the high visibility of disabled athletes, often had a profound impact on the host cities. While New Zealand was not hosting an Olympics nor a Paralympics, we felt sure that with some clever planning and execution, we could leverage the Rugby World Cup in a similar way. We believed we could use this event to create an accessibility legacy for Aotearoa. And several years later, that is exactly what we did with Be Accessible. But more on that exciting rollercoaster ride in just a little while. There was a critical piece of work that needed to happen if we were to raise the visibility and the value of access and accessibility advancement in Auckland. I reached out to the amazing Lisa Gestro at the Auckland District Health Board, ADHB, and the wonderful Nicola Mason, an old school friend from Palmerston North, all those years ago. She was now a lead researcher at AUT, and together we planned to undertake a very targeted piece of research. The brief was to look at the state of access in Auckland in the late 2000s, and to identify what would be needed to advance an impactful approach to improving access over the coming years. After 18 months of extensive work by a group of researchers, Step Up Auckland was finished. At last, we had an independent report that could categorically speak to the inequality, as well as the risks and the opportunities facing the 250,000 Aucklanders with disability. It would set out a series of clear recommendations for what was needed next. This was pure gold. Instead of just launching a piece of research, the communicator and ex-TV professional in me knew that we stood a much better chance of getting engagement if we could also create a video to bring the Step Up Auckland research to life. I reached out to Kui Jing Wong, a most amazing woman who was co-director of a production company called Borderless Productions. I had met her during my time on LNZ. What a life-changing reconnection that would prove to be. Kui Jing and her husband and business partner, Dean, had created Borderless Productions some years earlier. One of the very first social change films they had made together was called The Grandmother's Tribe. It focused on the very critical role grandmothers had played as primary carers in South Africa during the AIDS epidemic, which had left thousands of African children orphaned. As this award-winning movie was in subtitles, I could not read them when Kui Jing screened it to my group on the LNZ program. But being the wonderful woman that she is, Kui Jing proceeded to spend the next hour whispering the translation to me in my ear. If that is not a way to form a lifelong friendship, then I do not know what is. AUT hosted the launch of both the research and the supporting video at a special event, hosted by the new Vice-Chancellor, Derek McCormack. Each of the three partner organisations, AUT, ADHB and Auckland City Council, attended the event, and the amazing one and only Dame Tariana Turia, later to become Minister for Disability, launched this pivotal research. Of all the recommendations that Step Up Auckland made explicit that day, perhaps the most critical was the fact that an independent agency needed to be established in Auckland to provide reliable access advice to the region and to act as a central repository for access information and data. This was to prove to be the very first seeds of Be Accessible, the point of no return and the catalytic point of social change conception. By the time the Step Up Auckland research was launched, I had been with council for nearly 10 years. How had that happened? Well, one of the reasons I ended up working for the council for so long was because, like many disabled people, I got stuck in a role well beyond the time when I should have moved on. Due to the lack of employment opportunity, we are often just so grateful to have a job that we do not move on. This certainly was the case for me. I remained ghettoized at the bottom of a very, very large bureaucracy. Until I finally broke free and never looked back. And that day of liberation was now rapidly approaching. If I could not have the positive employment experience I so dearly wanted and needed, perhaps I should just get on and create my own employment instead. Perhaps I should just set up an entirely new social change agency.
I do so hope you enjoyed listening to my book and podcast series, Blindingly Obvious. It has been an absolute privilege to be able to share this with you. Listen out for the next chapter coming soon. If you would like to purchase the entire book in audio or an array of other accessible formats, including New Zealand Sign Language, or to learn more about my work, visit my website, minib.co.nz. Thank you for taking the time to listen and to be with me. See you next time. With love, Minnie B.